One of the things that can so often come to the foreground when we're reading the Perfection of Wisdom texts, hearing teachings on emptiness, steeping in this mysterious, you know, vast, non-dual approach to the Dharma, is that, you know, one of the maneuvers it does is that it scoops up all of the relative distinctions of our life, and in a sort of with those kind of insouciance, like insists that they don't exist. You know, says, oh, suffering beings, bodhisattvas save all suffering beings because there's no such thing as a suffering being. Bodhisattvas only are bodhisattvas because there's no such thing as a bodhisattva. The Buddha realizes perfect unexcelled enlightenment, but in doing so realizes nothing because there's no such thing as perfect unexcelled enlightenment and there are no Buddhas to realize it. And it just goes on and on like this, you know. The Heart Sutra makes it into, you know, a kind of rhythmic, path of negation. This was the old Christian term for this was the via negativa, the negative path, where it just says, you know, form is empty, feeling is empty, perceptions, formations, consciousness are empty, the path is empty, you know, all dharmas are marked by the characteristic of emptiness. So impermanence is empty, suffering is empty, selflessness is empty, emptiness itself is empty. And then it swings into the heart or the pith of the, like, knock it all down. It's like no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, and no mind. No sight, no sound, no smell, no taste. And just going on like just anything you might, congeal a kind of self or a concept, really. A self just means a concept of being someone, doing something. It says, no, it's not that. It's not that. You know, that thing doesn't really exist. Exist here is a particular, you know, it's a particular poor translation. That in a way these texts are existential texts. Existential in the West, really talking about a type of philosophy that tries to address the question of being and not being. What does it mean for something to exist or to not exist? If you describe something that you just made up, you might say that it doesn't exist, but you've just described it. And so it does exist as a kind of concept or an image. And so anything that can be described exists in some way. And the Heart Sutra and the Perfection of Wisdom texts insist that everything, including the Dhamma itself and Buddhas and people and every kind of being and every kind of experience, doesn't exist in the way that you think it does. And so it's different from Western existentialism. It's not actually talking abstractly about whether things, what it means for something to be. Say, oh, you know, is a thing real? These texts aren't actually engaging realness or non-realness. They're not, in an interesting way, they're not philosophical like that. The Western existential texts really try to take apart the problems in the concept of whether things are or in what way things are. And these texts, they don't do that. They do a very different thing. And what they do begins early in the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha would often say that he abides in the meditation on emptiness. And when he described that meditation, he would begin with the image of the city, which is busy and crowded and loud. And then he would say, meditating out here in the forest, is empty of the stress of the city. It's not busy, it's not crowded, it's not loud. In the same way, this moment's experience is empty of the stress of something that's not there. And the thing that's not there is identity, is swabhava, is the Sanskrit term. Own being is the awkward translation, or self-nature. Bhava is being or becoming. Swa is like in and of itself. The term in and of itself is a kind of a Kantian term, so that points to the Western existential tradition a little bit. Kant to Heidegger. But swabhava is like the essence or the substance of a thing, and it's not there. And so it's like saying, if we go with the example of the self, that the idea that I'm someone doing something, that I have a life story, that I have a purpose, that I have an identity that's distinct in the world somehow, there's the very pragmatic, like not so much philosophical, but pragmatic recognition here that narrative itself, the idea that I'm someone doing something for some reasons, that thing, it's not that it's not real, it's that it causes suffering, and it's not real in the way that you think it is. And the way that you think it is the way that you think, is that you think it's not malleable, or that it's kind of the ultimate truth in a certain way. I'm like this. And emptiness recognizes that all of the terms we use to describe ourselves and the story that we spin around who we are is a certain kind of fiction. Born of conditions, born of grasping. And that it doesn't ultimately hold us. It's not ultimately solid enough to hold us. We can see how it's subject to all of these, essentially like social and emotional forces. Grasping and craving being both emotional, energetic kind of forces, but also social in a way. Some of the main things we grasp at are how we are with other people. I'm like this with other people. We grasp at relationships being a certain way, people being a certain way, ourselves as people being a certain way. And so swabhava is the essence of myself, in this example, that is the solid core or the actor in the play of all this. The sense of myself being a kind of actor, being a kind of doer, is built into the grammar of the word karma. In Sanskrit, the two primary parts of speech in a sentence are not so much the subject and the object, but they are the doer and the done to. So like, I drink the water. The I is the doer, the actor, and it's called the karman. Karma means action, the doing. And the water is the thing that's done to, right? The water is what gets drunk. And so in a simple sentence, it coheres to subject and object. But in more complex sentences, like, I gave the water to you. In English, you would be the object in a certain way. In Sanskrit, the water is still the thing that the action is done to. That's not exactly the best example. I'll leave Sanskrit grammar. And so karma is the word for the one who does the action. And so the idea of swabhava is that there is a solid being, a solid essence that does actions, or who actions are done to. And then the Buddha has this radical teaching that was not common in his day. It was shared by some ascetic groups of his day, but not others. And the Buddha said, there's no one there. There's no solid core. He said, it's like a plantain tree, a banana tree, which is one of those kinds of trees. You know, the outside is made up of these like overlapping leafy things. If you peel it away like an onion, you never get to the heartwood. There's not a core. It's just leaves wrapped around leaves, all in a spiral. There's nothing there. Ultimately, it's all surface. So there's no core actor in your being. In the Perfection of Wisdom texts, then, this early meditation is developed from its roots as a meditation on a kind of serenity, a kind of deep peacefulness, freedom from stress, into this recognition that nothing has, that the thing that it's really empty of is this intrinsic identity. And that what that means, and that this is what the first several chapters of the Perfection of Wisdom tease out, is one of the first things it means is that the words we use for anything are empty, right? They don't really point to a solid thing. And this is why the sutra can say, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell, no objects of sight, etc. So when you're seeing, we have this concept that I, the seer, am using an organ of the eye to see a thing, and that all of those things exist. I'm solid, the eye is solid, the thing I'm seeing is solid. We know from the doctors and neuroscientists that, you know, the eye picks up a wild profusion of data and then sorts it using memory and narrative into the things we recognize. This is one of the things that can happen deep in vipassana, certain kinds of meditation, is you can start to disrupt that process where you are ordering the world as you perceive it, mostly through memory, right? You're not actually like over and over analyzing the rock and assessing it very deeply and having to figure out again every single day that it's a rock. You figured that out when you were one, and then you lodged it in habitual memory. And now whenever you see it, you don't really see what's right in front of you. The concept rock appears unconsciously in your internal mapping of the world, and then you don't think about it again, right? If we had to process every single thing, think about every word someone said and what it meant, and decode the world, we don't have the processing power for that. And so the vast majority of what we perceive is actually lodged in habitual perception. You know what it is, you figured out what it was the first time you saw it, and now you don't have to figure it out again. I think the sages that came up with the Perfection of Wisdom understood this experientially, and they got that actually we primarily live within an ecosystem of concepts. And that ecosystem of concepts is a kind of veil between us and everything. That it's a kind of coloring between us and everything. So that as I walk through the woods, my senses can be quite open to the beauty and the complexity of the woods. But I might notice that one of the things that's happening as I walk through the woods, like in the gully behind my house here, is that, for instance, the names of plants and animals, the birds and things that are there, but also my relationship to them, what they do, and how I feel about them, is the main thing that I'm walking through. So I am walking through a riot of greenery and color and sound and texture, but the main content in my experience is, you know, this is the blackberry that's sharp and pokey with occasional delicious berries. It has to be cut back. Oh, I should bring the weed whacker down here. The blackberry is invading the path here. Here's the fallen trees that my neighbor hasn't moved yet. I wish he would actually move these logs because they're blocking the path. And here's the forget-me-nots. And even just the names that I'm walking down. And it's like, there's the wild ginger and the redwoods and the Doug firs and the bays and the ferns and the horsetails and the little green frogs. And here's the muddy patch because the spring is here. And all of that is fine, right? That's essentially like the third and fourth aggregate perception and formations. And along with that is all of my preferences, right? I like redwoods. I don't like Doug firs so much because they're a little invasive. I really don't like the English ivy, and I medium don't like the blackberry except during blackberry season. And I really like the wild ginger, even though it's not native, and I don't like that, but it smells amazing. I really like the smell. And it just goes on like this. So that's the second aggregate, Vedana. So I see forms, and the forms are immediately enveloped in this like saran wrap of concepts. And the Perfection of Wisdom folks, they knew this. And they were like, that thing, when they say like there's no I self, but also no visual eye, you know, no object of seeing. Part of what they mean is that, and this is where the Heart Sutra starts, right? Form is empty. Oh, form is empty. The wild ginger, it's not wild ginger. Because wild ginger, the gorgeous, aromatic, non-native, you know, that springs up out of the swampy bit in our gully, that's a whole web of concepts. That speaks to my knowledge of who I am in the global ecosystem and so many things, concepts about what's right or wrong in my gully, you know? And so much in our practice and in meditation can point us. This is why we emphasize, you know, presence and the here and now so much. It takes shifting how we are in the world to be able to go into a place like the little wilderness behind my house and to quiet not just the surface stories. Like I can stop thinking about non-natives and, you know, where I need to weed whack the path and all that. Like I can quiet that easily enough. But the layer below that, and this is really the layer of perception and formations, sanya and sankhara, that is deep in the operating system. And so you have to get very quiet to get beneath those concepts. And the prajnaparamita points us toward that by saying, oh, those things don't exist. Right? Perception is empty. Formations are empty. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, so the six senses are empty. You know, feeling is empty. And so the meditation then is a meditation where I recognize that the thing that seems solid, right, the identity of the thing, the wild ginger, the redwood, that in a very subtle way is a stress in the nervous system, right? It's a stress partly because it gives rise to conflict, you know? It gives rise to conflict because Vedana, the second of the aspects, of the aggregates, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, pours forward into grasping, right? The Prajnaparamita is not far away from the basic teaching of the Four Noble Truths. Because contact is followed by feeling, I see it, I like it, I want it. You know, wasn't that like an Ariana Grande song a few years back? I see it, I like it, I want it, I get it. Right. So this is the four core links of dependent origination. So she's a sage for saying this. Right. There's contact, sensory contact. There's feeling. I know, sorry, millennials. There's contact, there's feeling, vedana. There's grasping, which is the emotional constriction of wanting, reaching out toward the thing. And then there's clinging, where you get it, you make contact, and you reorganize yourself around the holding on to that thing. Right? So that's stressful, right? To perceive anything in the redwood tree beyond the immediacy, in a certain way, of our two bodies and in a way, consciousnesses, awarenesses, all those are empty too. But to perceive anything beyond that, not to perceive, but to like fixate on, right? It's not that the concepts are wrong, but they're stressful. To fixate on anything other than that core presence, silent presence, is going to be productive of dukkha. You know, any idea I have of something is productive of dukkha. And this is why emptiness is, I think, most helpfully not an abstract philosophical concept, but it really is a meditation. It's also not a plan for your whole life. You know, like, it's not saying that you should go grocery shopping with this as your primary, you know, lens on things, except that you totally can, right? And it's kind of great. Just wander through the community market, seeing everything as empty. Because the thing that you can do here, and this is really where the Mahayana goes, is that seeing things as empty of svabhava doesn't imply anything about what you then do with them. So I can go down into the gully and empty myself of stressful concepts about invasive species, and I can quiet my mind and get very still, and I can still put my mask on and run the weed whacker around and clear the path. And I don't need all those concepts to do it. I know which plants are which. And the thing that's absent, if I do this well, is suffering, right? I don't need to suffer because the blackberry and the ivy are far vaster than my small actions can contain in any given year. And whatever you do in one year redoubles by the next year, and it's endlessly, you know, Sisyphean, especially the ivy. You just don't suffer. You just do your thing. You clear the path, and you're going to clear it again in March. And, you know, don't suffer. You go to the grocery store. Everything is wildly empty. But you know that your family prefers cauliflower over Romanesco, so you get the cauliflower, or you get the Romanesco. But it's okay, right? But you don't suffer. So that's well and good. Like, okay, go to the grocery store. That's well and good. But then God forbid, or not, you know, really. But you know, you turn on the news, or you talk to your family, or you talk to your sweetheart, or you go to work, or start talking about the war that's escalating, this war or that war or the other war that's escalating. There's several at the moment. And then it gets really difficult, right? Because you could say, in emptiness there is no Israel, no Gaza, no Hamas, no Hezbollah. There's no Jew, no Christian, no Muslim. There's actually no war. There's no life and death. You know, there's no hostage. Like, you could go there with emptiness, and that would be true in the perfection of wisdom. But you can hear as I say it. It's very strange to say it, right? Just to speak it that way gives me a sort of weird feeling, because this is not actually a choice between, you know, Romanesco and cauliflower, nor is it, you know, me addressing the blackberry in my gully. You know, this is a vast geopolitical tragedy that's consuming entire cultures and taking lives by the thousands and thousands, and and is the very definition of real, in a way, and serious and difficult, right? So it's important to, I think, take apart what this teaching on emptiness is actually suggesting around the world as it is, and how it's suggesting we live. And one thing about this is that this goes back to the, like, everything is empty, but it's essentially, the punchline essentially is everything is empty, but actions still matter and you have to make wise choices. That's really it. You know, I really just give the same talk over and over and over, but here it is again. The way that the emptiness teachings can resonate is that, like, you know, there's no such thing as suffering beings. Understanding this without fear, the bodhisattva saves all beings. There are no beings to be saved, therefore the bodhisattva saves all beings. One of the ways that you could interpret this is that practice is unnecessary, right? Practice essentially is doing actions on purpose that train the heart or the body or the mind toward states that were not available without practice, right? Practice is the cultivation of states. If everything is wildly empty, then, you know, meditative stillness and serenity is empty. And the crazy monkey mind that's neurotic and leaping around and completely miserable is also empty. And so fundamentally, neither one is more perfect than the other, right? Neurotic mind and blissful mind are fundamentally not, you know, one is not better than the other. They're both just ways that mind expresses based on conditions. So then what of practice? Does anything need to be practiced? It can seem from these texts, you know, if you take on this non-dual approach, that there's really no such thing as practice anymore. Why would you do that, right? And the Zen tradition particularly really likes this conclusion and emphasizes it all the time. I mentioned at the Facebook post this quote that it's a quote from the writings of Master Rinzai, the founder of the Rinzai Zen lineage. Rinzai is the Japanese name of the Chinese Chan master Lin Chi, from like the 8th, 9th century. And he was an extraordinary teacher and Zen master and Chan master, and his students took this practice to Japan, eventually founded the Japanese Rinzai lineage. And he really goes for it with this kind of like radical emptiness approach. And this line that always stuck with me from those years of Zen practice, at the peak of one of his sermons, he's going on about how, you know, stupid people are who don't get this. And he says, the true man of no rank, which is kind of a Chinese reference to like the enlightened being, right, the person who's gone beyond status and hierarchy, the man of no rank. The true man of no rank, what a shit-wiping stick he is. And the Rinzai texts love this kind of like this little turnabout, right? And Zen is full of this, right? All of this like this celebration of like radical non-ambition, you know. Someone accuses Hakuin Zenji of fathering a child with a local lay person. A young woman accuses him. A young woman becomes pregnant out of marriage, accuses Hakuin of fathering the child. The people accuse him of it. He says, maybe so. And then And then she goes to live next door to him. He helps to raise the child, does this for a long time. He gives a lot of energy to doing it. Eventually she feels remorse. She's kind of tarnished the relationship of this Zen master who didn't actually do it. And she says, I'm sorry, I lied. I was just trying to protect, myself and my lover. You didn't actually do it. And he says, maybe so. Like, baby come, baby go. It's almost sort of sociopathic in its dismissal of the reality of human relationship. And then, it's a teaching parable in the Zen world. When I was practicing Zen, I wanted them to tell me how to meditate. They gave me postural instructions. They were like, put your legs like this, tie your robe like this, make sure it's all nice and tight, sit really tall, hold your hands like this, that's it. And so I did that. And, but I would say like, well, okay, so I'm sitting, what should I do? When I'm meditating, what should I concentrate on something? What should I do? And they would, and the abbess just said, nothing. But what do you mean? Like, what should I do? And eventually I got up the nerve to ask the old Zen teacher, Joshu Roshi. I went in to answer my koan. I didn't answer my koans hardly ever to his satisfaction. But at one point I said, Roshi, how do you practice? Like, how should I practice? And he said, oh, I don't know. So that was the style, right? That was the house style in Zen. And in a way, it comes directly from this early layer of emptiness teachings don't get fixated on practicing. You're just adrift in the sea of birth and death, if you do that. But I want to read a passage that is not like this. So we're in the text we've been looking at for a few months now, The Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines. We're in the Edward Kanzi translation, and I've been slowly walking us through this, little tiny bits. I'm in chapter 17 right now, and it's talking about what's called the irreversible bodhisattva. How do you know that a bodhisattva is irreversible? In other words, how do you know that a person has really landed in this way of being called being a bodhisattva? We've already established that there's no such thing as a bodhisattva and that it's empty. That was like chapter 2, a long time ago. But having established that, how do you know when someone's really there? Subhuti asks, and the Buddha says, the level of the common people, that's like regular unenlightened folks, that's us, the level of the disciples, that's like the monks and nuns or the people who have attained stream entry, the level of the Pratyeka Buddhas, the level of the Buddhas, they are all called the level of suchness. Suchness is the word tathata. With the thought that all these are through suchness, not two, nor divided, nor discriminated, undiscriminate, they enter on this suchness, this nature of Dharma. After they have stood firmly in suchness, they neither imagine nor discriminate it. In that sense, do they enter into it? When they have thus entered into it, even when they have gone away from the assembly where they have heard about suchness, they do not hesitate, become perplexed, do not doubt, and are not stupefied by the thought that it is not thus. On the contrary, they firmly believe that it is just thus, just suchness, and like that, they plunge into it. Endowed with these attributes, tokens, and signs, a bodhisattva should be borne in mind as irreversible from full enlightenment. So it starts with a description of this kind of radical non-dual approach. You don't think about like the unenlightened people, the enlightened people, the various levels of enlightenment. You say all of this is just such. Suchness is a odd English word, but it's like the nature of everything being just the way it is. Everything is such. It's just such as it is, such as it is, right? Ordinary people, Buddhas, they all have the nature of suchness, of just being what they are. Suchness itself as a concept is empty, of course. So the Bodhisattva knows this. But then it says, okay, so an irreversible bodhisattva is like abiding in this profound non-dual understanding. But then they don't prattle away about everything that comes into their head. They only speak when it's profitable and not when it's not profitable. They don't look down on what others have done or not have done. So that they, just because they see everything in a non-dual way, they don't become foolish or bother other people. Furthermore, they don't pander to shramanas and brahmins of other schools, telling them that they know what is worth knowing, that they see what is worth seeing. They don't brag, you know? They don't go away. They don't hang out on Facebook getting in fights with people of other, you know, belief systems, as stupid as they may be. They pay no homage to strange gods. They're no more reborn in places of woe. And then here it really gets into action. An irreversible bodhisattva undertakes to observe the 10 avenues of wholesome action. These are the paramis, you know. This is like concrete things to do. And they observe and instigate others to observe abstention from taking life, abstention from taking what is not given, from wrong conduct as regards sensual pleasures, abstention from intoxicants, as tending to cloud the mind, and from lying speech, malicious, harsh, and speech and nonsense, abstention from covetousness, ill will, and wrong view. So the 10 waves of wholesome action, these are the 5 precepts plus these further elaborations of ethical action. And so here we really see the core piece that makes this not just a philosophy and not just a kind of intellectual abstraction. A bodhisattva doesn't just see everything as suchness and the text stops there. It's like, all right, good luck with that out in the world. It says, no, the bodhisattva observes the precepts, you know, doesn't break the precepts, isn't covetous, doesn't have ill will, even though the mind of ill will is just as empty as the mind of loving kindness, right? Intrinsically, both ill will and loving kindness have the nature of suchness, right? Both, you know, sexual misconduct and abstention from sexual misconduct have the nature of suchness. And the bodhisattva knows this, but they observe the precept. And this is the thing that was lost, if I'm going to talk about my Zen tradition, this is the thing that was lost in some Zen traditions. Because you can start with radical emptiness and you can end up with amorality, right? Nothing is really moral. There's nothing really to be done. And this is a mistake, the text says. Right. So then it goes on essentially into a description of disciplines on the path, right? Even in their dreams, they never commit offenses against these 10 precepts. They keep the 10 wholesome paths of actions present in their mind, even in their dreams. When they master a text of Dharma and offer it to others, they have in mind the welfare and happiness of all beings and offers that gift of Dharma in common to all beings without distinction. They speak what is beneficial, gently and in moderation. They have little sloth and torpor. They lose all the latent biases to evil. And then here, there's a quote that's almost directly from the Satipatthana, from the mindfulness text. We'll end with this. Whether they go out or come back, their mind does not wander, but their mindfulness is fixed before them. When they step on the ground, they know what they do. When they lift up or put down their feet, they neither loiter nor hurry, but remain at ease. So, this is the most basic teaching in meditation in the early tradition. They maintain mindfulness, right? They walk mindfully. They move through the world mindfully. And so this is very much a discipline, right? They're saying like they're not distracted. They are disciplining the mind and the body. And they're acting in ways that are wholesome, right? And it goes on to say their robe is free from lice, which is very nice. I prefer that, my robe to be free from lice. Their habits are clean. They are rarely ill. Their afflictions are few. In their body, the 80,000 families of worms which are present in the bodies of other beings cannot at all develop because their wholesome roots have elevated them above the whole world. And as those wholesome roots go on increasing, in due course, they will gain the perfect purity of body, speech, and thought. So that's interesting, right? Like, you engage in a moral and wholesome way in the world, and you are developing these beautiful, perfect qualities. You don't have them yet. You're developing them, but you're already an irreversible bodhisattva because you know how to perceive the world through the lens of suchness. But even though you do so, you never abandon the precepts, right? The core foundation of wise relationship that protects beings, yourself and others, from harm and suffering. So I think in here really is the key to understanding how this is both not as radical a turn from the ancient tradition as it sometimes seems, but also how it's really a pragmatic medicine for suffering in our ordinary life. This is partly why it could be turned into a good teaching for lay people, because even though it takes a significant amount of meditative stability to rest in the perception of that suchness, the actions that one then cultivates are coherent with lay people's practice throughout the tradition. Clarity in ethics, clarity in relationship, clarity in speech, and shaping all of our actions toward the well-being of others, really of ourselves and others. All right. So blessings in your practice. We'll pause here. Thank you for listening.